Okay, thank you. Yes, we're here on our appeal of the decision of Judge Kobayashi, whereby she had granted summary judgment to the defendant in our case involving disability discrimination and whistleblower protection act claims. You know, our position, the judge had indicated in her decision that she found that my client was not qualified for her position. We have indicated that the evidence would have shown, if allowed to go to a jury, that she was qualified for her position, despite the fact that she had asked for an accommodation to some extent regarding her driving to the various sites where she had to do the inspections. And the court found that there was no issue of material fact as to whether there was a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for termination. And our position is that there were issues related to whether or not there was a pretext for the termination.
Counsel, can I ask about the qualified factor? How was your client qualified for the job? If you walk through, when you walk through the reports, the performance reports, and the complaints that were received from the client, it's pretty glaring that she seemed not to really be able to perform her job. Does that affect whether she was a qualified individual for her job, or do we have to take the fact that because they let her stay on, that by definition meant that she was qualified for her job?
Well, I mean, she started working in 2010. She had some initial performance reviews which were negative. Her last reviews in 2013 and 2014 resulted in her being given raises. Yes, there were some issues pointed out to her with regard to
Well, I mean, just to be clear, I understand you want to put a good light on it, but I mean, it wasn't just some initial reviews that were bad. Every single review was bad. And, I mean, yes, she was given a raise, but she had a negative review, and I guess that's part of the question. Are we supposed to look at an individual and say, because they remained employed, they were a qualified employee? Or do we look at it and say, because they had the right to terminate her for failing to perform her job function satisfactorily, therefore she was not a qualified employee?
Well, I mean, like I said, earlier... Yes, she had some negative reviews, but she did improve. They kept her on. They gave her raises. They mentioned in that email in May 2015 that she was a very valuable employee. I mean, that's evidence that obviously, yes, she has some deficiencies here and there. You put the searchlight on things, but the fact of the matter is she was qualified. They kept her on. They gave her raises. They said she was a very good employee. Very valuable employee.
On the qualification issue, are you challenging the district court's refusal to consider what she called the take a break accommodation as not having been completed or raised prior to summary judgment? Are you challenging that ruling?
Yes, I am. Because the judge ignored the fact.
I'm not sure I saw that in your brief. Where is that? Just the discussion of the qualification issue on 29-30 talks about 30 minutes driving, but I didn't see it raising that issue.
The issue was raised on oral argument, and the judge ignored the fact that, in fact, the restriction was 40 minutes of continuous driving, whereas the judge said that the fact was that the restriction was 40 minutes of driving to the place where she had to do the inspection, and therefore the judge found that she couldn't get to all the places she needed to get to, which was not accurate, because the record shows that my client indicated at some point that if you can't give me the accommodation of giving me places that are closer to my house in Kailua, that's okay, because I can just drive for 40 minutes and take a break.
Well, let me focus further on that, because I look at the concise statement of facts which was submitted by defendants, and number 44 talks about that, and it says Boxholm and CTA were in Kaneohe in early 2016. Only 2% of providers were where CTA could reasonably guarantee BOP would not drive more than 40 minutes consecutively for on-site reviews. Assigning BOP only to such providers would have been less than a week of full-time work per month. And your response didn't dispute that. So why can't the district court simply say, well, that's a given, I can move on from here, and if you can only do 2% of the providers, you're not qualified?
Well, because that wasn't what the restriction was. The restriction was 40 minutes of continuous...
Well, you didn't dispute the conclusion. Their conclusion was that, as they understood it, she could have done less than a week of full-time work per month.
Yes.
And you said that's not true because she could stop, but your concise counter statement doesn't say anything about that. And indeed, as Judge Collins raised, it's not really clear to me that that's the argument that was offered up to the district court.
Well, because they were premising their argument and their position on that, the fact that it was a restriction of 40 minutes continuous driving and that the place had to be within that range. But the restriction was 40 minutes of continuous driving, and then she could take a break after that.
Is there anything in the record about how long the break would have to be?
I don't believe there's any discussion about that.
So, and I'm not sure how the employer is supposed to take that. If it's a 2-minute break or a 5-minute break, that's one thing. If it's a half hour break, that's quite another. It's not like we have lots of rest stops on the highway here. You can pull over and walk around. And none of this seems to be offered up to the district court as a reason for not accepting what the concise statement of fact offered by defendant seems to say.
Well, as indicated, when I did argue with the judge, I noted that the restriction was not that she could only drive for 40 minutes. It was she could drive for 40 minutes continuously, and then the record shows that there was an indication that that would not be a problem because she could simply take a break for however long.
But was that fleshed out? I mean, if there's nothing in the record about what a break constitutes, I'm not sure what we're supposed to make of that.
Well, that's why the case should have been allowed to go to the jury, you know. So we can
well, it doesn't issues. Go to the jury just because you haven't put in a record. If you don't put in a record to say that taking a break is practical, I don't know why the court should take that as a given. If you haven't contested the concise statement of fact that raises that issue, why should the court do that work for you?
When I got to oral argument, I realized that that was the position, and that's exactly what the doctor's note said. And it's in the record because she indicated, and even in their memos and on the appeal memos, they recognized the fact that she said it wasn't a problem because she could just take a break. I mean, that is.
But did she say what did she say in her deposition? What did your client say in her deposition? Because I thought she said. There's some suggestion by the district court that your client conceded she could only service 2% of the client. But when I went and read the deposition, that didn't match up. And so I'm wondering where, you know, it seemed like that your client had said, yes, I can only drive for 40 minutes, but she did not concede that that would only restrict her to 2%. Accessing 2% of the client.
Yeah, absolutely. And the record shows that later on in February, when they were having the discussion about the restriction, that it was clarified that there were only two places she couldn't go to, and that she could go to all the other places. So it wasn't limited to 2%. Because they were saying,
different. So it's different if your client doesn't concede that. But where did your client, you know, make this argument that there was a way for her to access all of the others? I viewed it as almost a silence, that it was sort of like, look, I can only drive, yes, it's true, I can only drive 40 minutes. But where did she say that is not going to prohibit me from servicing more than just 2% of the clients?
Well, my recollection is that one of the concise statement of facts of the defendant
but I think that's what Judge Clifton was just referencing, and it'd be helpful if you could point us to a place where I mean even if there were record evidence that was before the district court where your client actually said, well, you know, either in her deposition testimony or you pointed it out through something else, that this would not limit her to, because as it stands, it seems like the defendants have said this would limit her to 2%, covering 2% of the potential clients. And yes, while your client may not have conceded that point, I don't know where she's disputed that point either.
Well, again, I'd have to look at their concise statement of facts, but I recall when I was preparing for oral argument that there was a concise fact stated where my client did say that it would not be a problem because she could just take a break. Because initially she wanted to work closer to home. That wasn't going to be doable because there's only 2% of the homes within the radius of 40 minutes to Kailua. And then she said, okay, well, it's 40 minutes consecutive driving, what the doctor said, so I can just take a break, so I can do all these other things.
Your position is that you believe she said that in her deposition?
Well, I believe it's, that's one.
Well, she either said it in her deposition or she submitted an affidavit.
Well, I believe it's in their concise statement of facts that they made that as a fact, that she said it wouldn't be a problem. I mean, if I'm reviewing their concise statement of facts and I don't have a problem with that, yeah, that's her position, and they put that in their concise statement of facts.
Okay.
She said it wasn't a problem.
Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, why don't I reserve 2 minutes, so I'll, unless you have another follow-up question, I'll wait.
Yeah, if either of the panel, either anybody have any further questions, not, we'll let you reserve. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Ernst?
May it please the court. Joe Ernst for Community Ties of America. So first I'd like to kind of address this take a break accommodation or potential accommodation request. I think that it's worth noting to the court that this theory of the case was never raised prior to walking into an argument for a judgment.
Can you move closer, move the microphone closer to you? I really can't hear what you're saying.
Sorry, Your Honor, can you hear me a little bit better now?
That's better, thank you.
I'd like to address this take a break accommodation that was raised for the first time during the motion for summary judgment while we were before the district court. And I wanted to note that this take a break accommodation was not found anywhere prior to actually being in that motion for summary judgment.
It is in your concise statement of facts. Fact 45 says, England said CTA could not guarantee a limit of 40 minutes consecutive driving, particularly given traffic. Bach responded it was not an issue. She could leave the highway if necessary.
Right. The way we viewed that, though, is that first, that wasn't actually a request for a reasonable accommodation. That was disclaiming the need of her prior accommodation. But even assuming that it was, and that's fine. I think that we can assume that it was for the purposes of this. We granted that accommodation for her. There's nothing in the record that shows that we denied that accommodation. She said, it doesn't matter. I don't need the 40 minutes consecutively. I can pull off to the side of the road. And we said, okay, that I can't drive to Wahiwa to two of the providers. And we said, okay, we will reassign those. ultimately there's a little bit of confusion about what the termination consisted of. If you look at the concise statement of fact, the termination was really premised on all of these performance deficiencies and failing to meet the performance improvement plan, which Bach herself admits occurred.
So can I ask a question about that? I think it is clear that there was pretty widespread performance deficiency here. But how do we as a court analyze that in this particular case? Because it seems like you have not argued that those performance deficiencies made her not a qualified individual for the job. Is that correct? You've sort of waived that argument or conceded it?
Yeah, you know, I think that when you look at everything, that is likely correct. What we did, or what the court looked at that, the district court looked at that for, in essence, what we did is we moved from that step directly to whether we could articulate a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for that adverse action, which is...
So your position is, even if the court found a prima facie showing of pretext, your client is still entitled to judgment. The district court is entitled to be affirmed, should be affirmed, because before performance, there was enough showing that rebuts the pretext argument.
Yes, that's correct.
We're losing you again, counsel.
For us, when we examine this case, you know, we think that the crux of the case is really temporal proximity. So, you know, all of the concise statement of fact essentially has been admitted by Bach. That would be all of her performance deficiencies, the fact that she put on multiple performance improvement plans, the fact that she did not actually ever improve, that there were numerous complaints to providers that resulted in loss of licensure, that community ties actually investigated those complaints, whether they were valid or not before taking action, and then actually based on those reasons. So what is Bach's argument? What saves the case? The only thing that we can identify that Mr. Brower attempts to say that temporal proximity is enough. And that's true whether it's retaliation or the Why with the Protection Act or even the disability discrimination. When we look at temporal proximity, case law is pretty clear. 9 months alone is not enough to establish.
But the 9 months was, you know, they initially told her if you don't come back and you're going to be terminated, you won't have a job. And then, you know, they let her stay away for a while, and then she comes back with a performance plan that's kind of a glide path towards a termination. So it kind of looks like just a slow roll plan towards termination, at least on summary judgment, drawing inferences about that. I'm not sure the time really is all that positive.
Well, so I think that it's the time combined with all of the continued performance that Bach missed. But this is not a case where Bach has said, I wasn't underperforming.
That goes more to pretext. You know, the prima facie case, you know, often just comes from the sequence of events that raise an inference that, you know, driven by an improper factor.
Right. So I think that even if we assume, I think that our position has, we can assume that we take the prima facie case. But when we look at pretext, there's simply nothing there to dispute our legitimate reason.
But just to be clear on your argument on pretext, it's really twofold. First, it fails on the proximate cause standard because there was a 9 month delay. But regardless of the 9 month delay, it was still performance related, and that's why, in your opinion, the court should confirm. Is that correct?
That's correct. That, you know, irrespective of whether 9 months alone is enough to get you there, we have all of these intervening actions that occur between initially telling her that, look, we need to replace you because we have providers that need to be evaluated, and you yourself are saying you're not sure when you're able to return to work. and you know, and that unfolding, and then 9 months later, where essentially she has continued to perform very poorly. You know, this is not just a complaint from some of her coworkers that she may be, you know, rude or abrasive. These are serious misconduct. And she's looking at whether these licenses should be renewed, and she's evaluating them on criteria that are not part of licensure. She disputed certain documents that existed that resulted in one of the provider's clients no longer having a surrogate health care proxy. So, you know, as this all unfolded, it is clear that she is not, in fact, getting better, no matter what they do to try to help her improve. Given that, the fact that it was getting worse and worse as time to terminate.
Can I ask about, on February 3rd, 2016, England scheduled a meeting with Fox. It sounds like, as I understand the facts, England had determined that she would be fired. But he didn't tell her that, obviously. He didn't say, hey, come in, we're going to talk about your separation. He just said, come in, when are you available for a meeting? And she said, I'm available on February 11th. But she didn't know, well, I guess this is a question, was there an inference or some basis for her to know that that meeting on February 11th was going to be termination?
I don't believe so. I don't think that Bach would have had indication that that was going to be a termination meeting based on the discussion with England. I think that when England spoke to Bach or sent that email, she wanted to not necessarily hold that out, but say, you know, come in and talk. I don't think that it's generally standard procedure to tell an employee, hey, I want to schedule a meeting a week or two later to fire you.
No, but I just wondered if there was something where she would have anticipated that. It's just, sure. The timing is interesting because 2 days later after setting up the meeting, then she emails with the decision to know. And so it made me wonder whether there's something in the record that would suggest that she had a sense that, you know, this note needed to be obtained so that, you know, she could try and get some protection in some way. I don't think so. It was coincidental.
I don't think that there's anything in the record. I think that, you know, typically when an employee is significantly underperforming or there's complaints or she's not getting along with providers, it's probably an indication that it may not be working out.
But the fact that England... I guess that's the question. When England emailed her to set up a meeting, the fact that was that unusual? Would England have had other meetings if this was just in the normal course? Or she would have said, oh, wait, this is a supervisor. I'm, you know, maybe this is getting attention by poor performance.
Yeah, I do not believe that England typically had meetings with these managers on any regular basis. You know, if there was a problem, she would meet with them to discuss, you know, your reports are not, you know, correct, or there's missing information, or, you know, whatever that would be. But certainly didn't meet, you know, regularly just to, you know, talk story or to say, you know, how are things going. So there may have been an indication in Bach's mind that this was probably a serious meeting.
Okay. And then my second question is, England testifies later or states later that meeting was going to be a termination meeting. Is there something in the record contemporaneous that suggests that that the decision had already been made to terminate her on February 3rd?
Sure. I think that if you look at the documents that support the concise statement of fact, it shows that England had reached out to the home office in Tennessee to request the last paycheck issued and then mailed from Tennessee to Hawaii. So the date of that email combined with the date of what the final paycheck was shows that the termination decision happened prior to that February discussion about reasonable accommodation. Essentially, I just wanted to kind of pull this up by saying, you know, what Bach is asking is for not just all inferences, not just what she's asking for is all inferences to be drawn in favor of her, but But case law does not say all, meaning all, really all reasonable inferences. So those that are too speculative or fantastical should not be drawn in favor of Bach. Here, you know, looking at this mountain of evidence of non-performance, CTA believed that to draw the types of inferences that Bach asked would in fact be fantastical or unreasonable. And to adopt that standard would essentially make motion for summary judgment a nullity. An employee who's significantly underperforming can simply make a complaint and then quote themselves an invincibility. And then an employer could never take action to do anything unless it goes to trial to try to defend itself. And I think that this court has previously held exactly that. In Mitchell, the court stated, we refuse to make a complaint tantamount to a get-out-of-jail-free card based solely on timing of an original complaint. To do what Bach is asking would actually be a marked departure from employment discrimination. So for these reasons, I think the court's decision should not be disturbed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brower, you have a little over 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Yeah, so following up on a comment from Judge Collins with regard to the May issue, I mean, our position is that what happened in May of 2015 when they told her she didn't come back to work by May 11th, which was contrary to their policies and also FMLA, you know, it shows their intent that they wanted to get rid of her after she had that surgery on her hip. And what happened after that was they set the whole thing up. You know, they did the September 21st plan, and they were supposed to follow up with her, but they never followed up with her at all. They never notified her in any way, shape, or form that there were any deficiencies. They didn't give her the end of year 2015 review. There are no, and I reviewed again Exhibit 30. You know, it's not this serious misconduct. I mean, my client came a couple of hours early, did a couple of visits, and the people in the home were said they thought that she was coming later and they weren't ready. And I mean, if you read Exhibit 30, the results of the insurance pool, this is not serious stuff. I mean, she shows up early, so what? I mean, maybe it was some misunderstanding about the time. And then also, there's no evidence in the record of any communication with the owners and Ms. England in February about the termination. They may not have an email back and forth. There were no emails about, hey, we're going to, you know, I agree we should terminate, et cetera, et cetera. And also, I dispute the fact that...
Well, what about the request for a final check? That's pretty conclusive, isn't it?
Look, I dispute the fact that there's anything in the record about an email requesting a final check. She said that in her declaration, but I double-checked the record. Unless I missed something, there is no email to support the fact that she requested a check, and that came up later to justify their termination, which they say, oh, we made that decision before she ever gave us that note from the doctor, which is not true, not supported by the record.
Okay, counsel, I think we have your argument. Thank you both for your arguments today on this case. The case is now submitted.